Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire hits theaters and director Gil Keenan joins the show to discuss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 303 of Real Blend, a podcast that promises to never cross the streams. On this week's show, Ghostbusters is back in theaters with its latest sequel, Frozen Empire. And on behalf of the new Ghostbusters movie, we have writer and director Gil Keenan joining us to discuss. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast, joined as always by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin. How are you, sir?
Good. Two things. Love the sound. I love the sound of 303. I hope it's like that number too.
It's nice. There's a symmetry to it. Yes.
Yeah. Sean and I talk a lot about symmetry and coincidences all the time. I just love the way that sounds. And also, thank you for introducing me first. And
we're two and two.
I love watching Jake's face when you introduce me first.
We have somebody keeping score, I think, in the comments now. Episode by episode. At least post 300, they've been keeping score.
And I'll tell you what the problem with that is. Now I see that, and now I'm aware of it, and now I have to keep balance. I'm going to have to try my best to keep balance.
I do have a question, because Sean is the father of the show, literally. Yes. And he has these three kids that he has to keep all their egos in check and all this stuff like that. But my question is, in the past, or maybe even now, when did you decide who you introduced first? Was it on your sheet of like, I'm going to Kevin and Jake?
Never.
Like, it's completely moment.
It is always in the moment.
I can pull the curtain back. All I put on here is intro guys on our run of show. Like, you just handle that.
That's what it says.
Intro the kids.
And it's literally always in the moment. Yeah. And I don't know what drives it forward, but now it'll be the fact that someone's keeping track of this. In the other chair, Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. It's blue tie, red tie day today, folks.
Yeah. Gray suit. We go gray from suit, blue suit, Matrix. Red suit to blue tie, red tie.
Yeah, I like what you guys are doing very subconsciously for the people who are watching on the YouTube channel. Let's say hello to Gabe Kovach in the producer's chair. Hi, Gabe. How are you?
I'm good. Things are going well on our end, so having fun.
There are so many reasons why you should be watching us on YouTube besides how dressed up the boys look. But basically, come on over here and check us out on the YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Give us a like and a subscribe. We are, again, as mentioned, adding subscribers at a rapid clip. And a lot of that is due to the success of the Dune 2 interviews. Thank you very much to Hans Zimmer. Thank you to Rebecca Ferguson, who is a gift that keeps on giving with her incredible answers and just the way that she tells stories. She's a social media delight. So please head over to the YouTube channel and give us a like and a subscribe. What's up, Kev?
I want to say something real quick. Well, shout out to Gabe real quick, just because of all the editing that the team has been doing behind the scenes with these clips and shorts that we have. But the reason why I want to bring that up, one, the editing is fantastic. It's getting our show out to a much larger audience. If you're on YouTube, check out the shorts section of our Real Blend YouTube channel. But today, it was probably the first time this has ever happened to me, especially in the time that we've done our show. I was just on my normal Twitter feed going through, and I see a quote tweet from some person I don't follow that was like basically joking about how Rebecca Ferguson, I hope she never gets media training. And it was a clip of our interview with Rebecca.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it going, wait, that's our show. And then I opened up the clip. The clip has 4.5 million views and it hasn't even been up for 24 hours.
Like, it's insane.
What is going on? This is crazy. So thank you for everybody listening to our show. And thank you to any new listeners who may have found us because of these clips that Gabe has been posting. And so thank you for all
Gabe,
the support.
When does your raise at Cinema Blend kick in?
Oh, this is my show. I just came here to say I quit. I am now I'm so rich from, you know.
Funneling money off the shorts.
Yeah.
It is absolutely insane because I quote tweeted that, and I know we'll move on to Gil, but I quote tweeted it and I was just saying, like, we passed 300 episodes on our show And it is kind of crazy to think about it. We celebrated our 300th episode with four massive names from Dune Part 2. Like, yeah. Dune Part 2 was part of our show for a month, essentially.
Well, and one of the funniest comments I saw underneath, too, because the YouTube channel, we recently crossed 20,000 subscribers, and we're thrilled to have as many people as we are. But, like, someone wrote underneath, and they were like, how does a channel with only 20,000 subscribers get these people? And I was like, you know, it's a long story.
I still get, on my YouTube channel, I've got a few more subscribers than that, but I still get comments about, like, how does this guy get these interviews? And my response is, I don't always respond. I used to respond a lot more than I do now, but I used to respond, I ask nicely.
Yeah. Part of the equation.
That's all it takes. If you've signed up for Real Blend Premium yet, guys, now that you're here, it gets you an ad-free version of the show. It also gets you a newsletter by me. I'm going to have one this week for everybody. I think I know what I'm going to talk about. You guys will find out on Friday when it arrives in your inbox. Check the description for information on where you can sign up. Earlier this week, we did a bonus episode because Jake and I were down in South by Southwest on behalf of the new Netflix series, Three Body Problem. Thank you to our friends from Netflix for inviting us out to the premiere of the first two episodes of that show.
And I wasn't there, so they've now changed the show to Two Body Problem. That's the podcast version of the show.
Well, we had a one body problem, and it's that your body wasn't there.
Exactly. Yes. But that interview is up on all of our different channels. So check out Three Body Problem, which will be on Netflix now by the time you guys are listening to this, and then go back and listen to that episode. It's relatively spoiler free. We kept it limited to the first two episodes, and then we're going to talk about that show a little bit later in this show.
A great story about how difficult it was for them to write or watch the last season of Game of Thrones in public, because if they were on a plane or at an airport, people were always looking over their shoulder onto their laptop, and resulted in them having to cover themselves on a plane to watch the final episodes, which just looks bad. Yes, on a plane.
It does. Looks very awkward. But in the meantime, while you guys are thinking about Three Body Problem, hopefully you're also heading out to the theaters this week to see, in various formats, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, the continuation of the rebooted Ghostbusters franchise. And we have Gil Keenan, who wrote Ghostbusters Afterlife with Jason Reitman and is now taking over the director's chair. And so this is Gil Keenan joining the Real Blend podcast on behalf of his new film, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I'm going to hit you with one of the hardest hitting questions that we have right off the bat, though, Gil. So I want you to strap in.
Oh, yeah, here we go.
I'm curious if there's a backstory that explains how the Spin Doctor's CD became possessed.
That was the best joke in the whole movie. Thank you so much.
I'm really proud. You know, two words for a certain age of audience. No two words can be funnier as a band name.
When conjured doctors.
When conjured back up. You know, I could give you that story, but it would deprive you of an entire film that delves into that sordid saga that we are planning. In fact, a trilogy that goes into a hard R, fully committed trilogy that delves into the sordid history, and it is sordid.
Get a little Blues Traveler in there.
Don't even chapter. Go there. We've got we could take that road all the way down to hell.
Are you going to call this movie Little Miss Can't Be Wrong? I really this needs to happen. Please.
Can you guys at least acknowledge the amount of restraint it took for me not to put any of those songs in the end credits? And also, it shows tremendous restraint as a filmmaker, and I think I deserve at least a little bit of credit for that.
Because the other flip side of it is just if you just did Arnold ice puns for 90 minutes.
I mean, what I'm wondering is actually how much of our audience understands what the hell that object is that that Gary Gruberson raises, that yellow plastic object with a clamshell that moves up and down. Yeah. I'd be curious to know how many are actually able to engage with that prop.
Show it to Finn and McKenna and see what they say.
hold that thought. I'll walk over to the next room and check.
I don't have a Spin Doctor's question, so this is just going to go downhill from here. Yeah. Gil from here. All right, here we go. So, hey, all right, real quick. There's a quote that Aykroyd has in the movie that I think was so profound that I remember walking away from the film going, what a beautiful sentiment. He goes, this is the way I want to spend my golden years. It's what I love.
Yeah.
And I remember going, damn, what a beautiful thing. I mean, you think about that character, how much he loves what he does and kind of like in that element. I just wonder for you as a filmmaker, what that line means to you. And do you think 20, 30, 40, 50 years in the future, you'll feel that same way about being in your golden years and wanting to still do what you love?
First of all, thank you for raising that sentiment from Ray. I'm really proud of that moment between Ray and Winston, because to me as a fan, it speaks to both the kind of longevity, the staying power of Ghostbusters as a cultural institution, and also as a fan, the sort of relationship that we have with characters, right? How they extend in every direction, even when they're not on screen every year or every 10 years, even in the case of Ghostbusters. We believe in these characters and their inner life in a way that when they do show up on screen and they talk about their history, shared history, and their desire to continue into the future, that means something, because it sort of speaks to a lifelong relationship sometimes that we have with characters. And so when Dan says that this is how he wants to spend his golden years, it's a comment both that is literal to him as a character, but also speaks to our relationship as fans with a deep respect for who Ray Stantz represents, Winston Zeddemore, Peter Venkman, Janine Melnitz. These are characters we care about. We want to see them continuing into the future. And yeah, of course, if I'm lucky enough to get to tell stories 20, 30 years from now, you know, we weren't shy about talking about the metaphor that in afterlife, ghostbusting stood in for filmmaking, because there was a sort of a generational passing of the torch between Ivan and Jason. And in many ways, the proton pack was the symbol of that continuum, right? And so, of course, now we've sort of made much more personal the connection between ghostbusting and the people. And I don't just mean me as a director, or Jason as director for Afterlife, or us as writers or producers, whatever. It's the entire community of people who come together on every side of the camera, whether it's fans, whether it's the artists working to make the movie, who all sort of put ourselves into these journeys we take with the characters. So that stuff means something. And I do think with that, you know, if the movie works for an audience, I hope that it's because it acknowledges and pays a respect to our lifelong relationship with this saga.
Yeah, that line made me teary-eyed, man. Great line.
Gil, we talking a text thread. We have another host who's doing the TV slots right now, and it immediately coming out of our different screenings of this. And I want you to hear this. We had a conversation that we said, essentially, this movie feels like if they had just kept making Ghostbusters movies, this would have been the next one.
The greatest thing I've heard since we started screening this movie. Thank you so much. I really take that to heart. That means a lot. Thank you.
Honestly, the tone, it fits so well with one and two, but there's an element of it that I love that you get to do. I've been an enormous fan of yours since Monster House. Monster House is one of those movies that I can't wait to show my kids. Like, they're now teenagers, but when they were younger, that was their entranceway into horror movies and scary movies was Monster House.
Thank you.
And you get to do a little bit of fun animation when you're telling the backstory of your villain. Can you talk about just reverting to your animation ways and doing some stop motion to build that sequence together?
Thank you so much for asking about that. That's the first time I've been asked about it. I know the dark magic of animation. It's an incredible tool that can be used for the powers of good or evil. It allows you to expand the storytelling universe in ways that really only animation can do. It allows you to peel back the curtain and look into the void sometimes. I knew once I put this film together that we always had these sort of photographs in the book, but it was only once I sort of put the film together that I felt the need to delve a little deeper into that mythology. I've always loved mythology in movies, and I feel like there was like a movement to sort of pull back on them a little bit because people used to say that there was like too much exposition in films, and so then there was kind of a movement in storytelling to get away from somebody actually telling you a story. But you know what? That's kind of why I got into this whole racket in the first place, because I want to be told a story. And when I'm on the other side of the camera, I want to tell a story. I want to feel like I've got you there right where I want you. You're in a dark room. You're already seated. You're mine. I'm going to tell you something. And in that sequence, it felt like a moment where we could do something a little bit unusual for a Ghostbusters film, which is bring images to life in a fully animated way. I worked with a small animation. So the entirety of this film, almost bar a couple of little moments, was done by one visual effects house, the Sony Pictures Image Works, the same company I did Monster House with all those years ago. They killed it. Mm-hmm. But this particular sequence, I knew who to do it with. It's a very, very tiny animation house in London called Studio AKA. I worked with them on my last film, A Boy Called Christmas, too, for a shadow story sequence. There's an animator there named Marcus Armitage, who I called up, said, I have this idea. I did a bunch of little drawings, storyboards for it. And sent him my reference images. And it was just like the most incredible dynamic process. I felt like while I was making this big giant movie, I was making a short film that was really personal and really fun. Yeah. It was almost my like island of salvation, where I would get out of meetings where I was talking about like waging war on a massive scale. And I would come back to this kind of tranquil moment of zen. It's a joy, and it was really fun to bring to life.
It really is awesome. Plays great.
Thank you.
Gil, I think this is interesting. Like when I walked away from the film, I thought about how much fun I had with it, but I was also thinking a lot about thematics. And like there's two elements in the film that I think are really fascinating. It's the idea of being a kid and wanting to be an adult and taken seriously. Yeah. And then being a parent or a step parent and trying to discipline children, but not be an a-hole, essentially. And it's a really interesting thing about how that comes across. But specifically on the idea of being a kid and wanting to be an adult and not being trusted because you're 15 years old, even though you have the smarts and the energy to do it. When you were growing up, was that something that you felt conflicted with? Like, because I'm turning 40 next week, I guess the day your movie comes out.
Amazing.
Weirdly enough.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
It's his birthday gift to you, Kev.
Yeah.
It's the least we could do, honestly.
I appreciate it. I mean, I know Reitman had that in his mind the whole time. I got to get that guy's 40th birthday. But I do think now, when I was younger, I wanted to be an adult. Now that I'm 40, I wish I would have spent more time as a kid thinking I was a kid. And Paul Rudd said that in the interview. He goes, when I was a kid, I actually just kind of enjoyed it. I never wanted to be an adult. And so I just found that to be interesting, because I was curious what your relationship like with that was. Well, and I thought those themes were really important.
It's nuanced. I definitely felt very responsible as a young person. And for a bunch of different reasons, I have a younger brother who's healthy now, but was very sick when I was a kid. He's 4 years younger than me, and that made me grow up much earlier because I sort of had to and feel like I was kind of almost a third parent in a way, even like at 8, 9, 10 years old. So I definitely had a bit of that kind of Phoebe Spangler sense of self-empowerment and my own agency. I've always been determined to be a filmmaker and a storyteller, completely at odds with anything my family is any sort of frame of reference for. And that was a self-driven goal that I had from a very young age. And, you know, so I've always felt that kind of agency. And I think that is something that is, for some young people, seeing that reflected on screen, warts and all, right? Because for Phoebe, it's not a straight line from who she wants to be to how she can get there. There are obstacles, some of her own making. And I think that sort of nuance is really, it's really healthy for younger audiences to see in a film that otherwise is and entertainment, right? And
right.
You can sort of see yourself in it. The other thing is, I'm a dad now. I have a daughter who's 15. She's about to turn 16 on Monday, like exactly at the age that Phoebe Spangler is in this story. My daughter's very different from Phoebe, but in some ways, she's also fiercely independent. She's also had a real poise and a sense of her own agency and dignity from a kind of younger age that you would imagine those qualities would be assigned to. And watching that journey of somebody coming into their own, but also still needing to at times turn around and cling on to their parents. And you realize that actually that line between adolescence and adulthood, it's not a one-way street. Sometimes you have to leap back and cling on to the moments, the instincts that shaped us and feel safe still from our childhood. And other times you have to leap forward into that kind of wild, scary independence of adulthood. And it felt natural to Phoebe as a character, and it felt, authentic to myself and to Jason. One of the shared, elements that Jason and I have had over the years, in addition to many other things that have sort of bound us as friends and creative partners, is we both have one teenage daughter. Like his daughter is like a year and a half older than mine, but we used to go on camping trips together. Those trips were where we used to work out stories on those long drives. And we have had front row seats to the kind of adolescent development of young people. So all of that stuff is in our heads as we're writing and crafting these stories.
A quick follow up, real fast, because you mentioned you have a daughter, and then Carrie was telling me in the interview that she was happy that this was written as a real mom, with flaws and everything. And I think that's an interesting thing, because as a filmmaker, you're talking about yourself having a daughter. There's this whole bit in the movie about how Paul and Carrie don't know how to really kind of discipline their children. And I don't have kids. Sean has two kids, so he's probably better equipped to know this as well. But I wouldn't know how to talk to a child that way. You don't want to come across mean, but you also need to come across assertive.
It's a difficult journey, and you'll find that in a lot of couples, there is sort of one parent that is the kind of disciplinarian. Yeah. It's almost always a good cop, bad cop scenario. And for better or worse, in a lot of families, it's the dad gets off easy, right? Like a lot of times dads get to come in and like show the kid The Exorcist when they're 10 years old. I think that there is for Gary Gruberson as a man coming in from the outside, who obviously cares so much about the Spanglers, about Carrie, who he has a relationship with Trevor and Phoebe. But in his arc, I think that there is a relatable driver that a lot of parents will relate to, which is, what is that line between being like the cool friend who is hanging around and is playing a kind of more, friendly supervisorial role, to somebody who is actually able to call you out when you're making a mistake and go to, an uncomfortable place that might create more static in the short term? That's part of parenting. That's part of human, you don't have to be a parent to know that conflicts are easier to avoid, but sometimes you have to engage, and sometimes that's how you show love, because it shows that you have enough investment in the other person to be able to go there.
People are probably listening to this and saying, this is a Ghostbusters movie, right?
There are ghosts in this film. When did this become a parenting self-help chat? This is great.
I told Paul and Carrie that earlier. I'm like, why am I having these deep thematic conversations with you about a Ghostbusters movie?
But that's what the movie is. I want people to understand that. So, Gil, the movie ends with a title card, and it says to Ivan, as it should, of course, his legacy, is the motor that drives this franchise forward. What is the sequence that you wish you could sit down with and watch with Ivan and just get his feedback?
I wish so much that Ivan could have been there last night to watch the entire film with an audience full of Ghostbusters fans. you know, Jason and I, this is obviously a very personal subject to get into, and I want to be really sensitive about how I talk about this because I care so much about Jason and his sisters, his family, and we all feel the loss of Ivan as fans and myself as a filmmaker, but for them, it could not be more personal. But we had the extraordinary good fortune of being able to sit down with Ivan, Jason and I, to pitch him the entirety of this story before he passed. Oh, wow. Obviously, we didn't know that we had so little time with him. We were sitting in his garden and we pitched the entirety of the film. And his joy at hearing this story, where we were taking it, his validation, the sort of... go forth and do your work that we came out of that conversation with was wind in our sails for every day of this film.
Right. What a treasure. That's incredible.
We were very lucky to have Jason and Ivan on our show together for the last Ghostbusters. And I got to tell you, as a kid who grew up watching the first one and trying to understand practical effects and how, and like hearing Ivan break down the egg sequence in front of his son and then how the proton packs have changed since then and now. It was just such a fascinating thing to have, like, that.
Amazing. Oh. Yeah. That's magic. Yeah. And you know, I mean, that guy changed movie history. He's a god.
100%. Yeah, yeah. You know, I think this is partially one of Jake's questions as well, our other co-hosts who couldn't make it here at the moment. But there's a classic Ghostbusters theme and score and like the piano aspect. There's like a very classic aspect to it. And it's dropped in perfect moments. And Jake usually asks this question about like, when do you find the right moment to drop in a theme like that? I mean, for me, it was like Murray popping up and you just hear that classic. Like, it's just such a piece of music that's so phenomenal. But then obviously you have a composer here as well. So you have to kind of blend those worlds together. So can you talk about how that works when you have classic and new themes?
Yeah. I mean, look, you wouldn't make a Star Wars film without invoking the Star Wars right. theme, right? It feels like it's right there. Like, do the smart thing. Yeah. Use the music, but use it in the right moment because it's actually incredible going back and listening to that original Ghostbusters soundtrack, because first of all, it's a phenomenal piece of music writing, but it's also all over the map in terms of tones and instruments. It's just perfectly tailored for that film. It could never work if you took all that music and applied it to a modern movie. It would just It would just not work. And so the process for this film first started with my collaboration with Dario Marinelli, who I've worked with before. Dario is a genius. He's an extraordinary composer. And he wrote a score of music for this film that was so intelligent in its use of the Elmer Bernstein cues in just the right places to give you, exactly as you said, that suggestion of the past without ever letting go of its tight grasp on the narrative and tone of the film that we were making. And I'm really proud of the music that Dario wrote. I'm proud of the way that it was recorded with the participation of Elmer Bernstein's son, Peter Bernstein, who orchestrated the original score in 1984. So he knew where all the notes were buried and how every sound was arrived at. Peter was there every single day that we were recording the score of this film. And Dario would consult with him about, you know, I'm trying to get this sort of sound. How did you guys do it in 84? And Peter would be able to give in the field cues about how to make those adjustments. Also, importantly to the soul of this film, because just like we're using practical effects, there is an element of using some of those original instruments to capture that sound. There are some specific synthesizer cues that were performed in 1984 on what at the time was like a cutting edge Yamaha synthesizer that almost immediately after that film became kind of obsolete. But we dragged out that original instrument, plugged it into the main boards on this massive recording studio at Sony. And Peter Bernstein, Elmer's son, is the guy performing that synthesizer line on his dad's on his dad's instrument. I mean, the legacy runs deep in Ghostbusters. There's lineage in every direction.
That's amazing. Wow. Well, that feeds me right into this last question. We're going to get you out of here on this one before we run out of time. There's a brief moment in the film where because you're back in New York City, which is so important to the Ghostbusters, obviously, they start to quick backfill like the history of the team and some things like the Ray Parker video, you know, of the guys dancing with Ray Parker Jr. becomes canon now to your universe. And there's commercials that I saw as a kid when I was eating cereal, you know, that get pulled in. And I know with Afterlife, Jason talked about the you know, embarrassment of riches of archival stuff that's available to him. Like, was that also available to you? What was the coolest thing that you got to pluck from the actual cast of the movie? And
perfect question. I haven't had a chance to talk about this yet. This is one of the things I'm most excited about as like a little, you know, backstory of the making of this film. I knew that we were going to be bringing the library ghost back into this film.
Yes.
And I knew we were going to create a lot of her performance using a practical puppet that was going to be built to the exact same specifications of the original puppet. But the element that I still needed to figure out was the human performance of that ghost before the transformation. And Nicole Rowley, who is the visual effects producer on my film, went through the entire log of the original post-production office, the editing room for the 1984 film, which means as they closed down that film, once it got into theaters, the assistant editors wrote down every scrap of film that they had and were archiving. She went through hundreds of pages and found one interesting marking on a logbook that said 70 millimeter librarian. And that's kind of all it said. And she went through the work of having that archival bit of film pulled from the mines, wherever they store this stuff in like Utah. And we got in a box, a pristine roll of 70 millimeter film that had not been unspooled since 1984. We put it on the big screen at Sony and we had no idea what we would find on there. And the image flickered to life. And it was the most extraordinary experience. It felt like we had just pushed a button on the DeLorean to travel back to 1984. There was raw, incredible, pristine 70 millimeter material of Richard Edlund, the visual effects supervisor on the 84 film, filming the librarian shushing the Ghostbusters. And so we were able to use takes that had never been used before in Ghostbusters to create a new performance out of that archival material. And it just felt like movie magic. It was like, this is why we do what we do. I should release that stuff, actually. Maybe if you guys ask through the folks, maybe we can send a clip of that or something so you can.
Oh, my God. We would love that.
Oh, we can drop it into the interview.
So cool.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that would be fantastic.
So cool. Yeah.
Gil, we are enormous fans of you, man. We'd love to have you on for the rest of the day.
That was so fun. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, I hope we hit you with a few you didn't get to hear.
That was all fresh. It felt like a real conversation. Really grateful. Looking forward to talking to you guys again. Thank you both. And to your mystery partner who just happened to not be here today. Thank you, guys. Have a wonderful day and see you out there.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We want to thank our good friends at Sony Pictures for getting us time with Gil Keenan. I was really happy to be able to mention Monster House to him, his animated film from early on. And legitimately, that has become like a gateway drug to the horror genre for my boys. Like, that was one of those films that I kind of circled and was like, I cannot wait for you guys to see this, because I really, really love the way that he treated the haunted house aspect and the sort of Amblin-esque, you know, kids on an adventure type thing. So I love to see him moving into live action. And I'm really happy that he's the dude who's kind of taken over the Ghostbusters franchise and running with it, because my reaction overall to Frozen Empire, you know, it's not a tremendous film by any stretch, but if they had continued to make Ghostbusters sequels, you know, after one and two, and just sort of stuck with the tone of those movies, that's, I thought Frozen Empire kind of falls into that natural progression. It's not nearly as, you know, the first one's always going to be the first one. It's going to be up on this pedestal. And I'm not quite sure that the people making that movie ever thought that they were going to make a second one. But as they continue to make, you know, films where people put on proton packs and chase ghosts around New York City, this one falls in line with those. I thought the tone was really fun. I thought it had a lot of good jokes in it. I really appreciated its reliance on practical effects. There's a bunch of other movies that are coming to theaters that we're going to be talking about that are overly CGI heavy. And I think seeing Frozen Empire right in the middle of that, where there's legitimate car chases and even some of the ghosts and creatures are like adorably, you know, practical. I was like, I just appreciate that. I think that that's great. So, you know, it's not going to change the world, but I ended up having a lot of fun with it. And I think the fans are going to sort of buy into what he's doing. Kev, did it work for you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, this was the closest film that they've made to the first two, obviously. We've been saying that in our text thread. I do have some issues with this movie that I'll dive into. But on a positive note, to me, the McKenna Grace character and her arc is absolutely incredible. Yeah. I love that character. I love Phoebe. One of the things I really heavily related to in this film, we talked to Gil a little about this, was the idea of when you're a kid and like not being taken seriously if you're under a certain age. Yet at the same time, McKenna's character has more capability to take down ghosts than her mom and Paul Rudd's character. Mm-hmm. And so I found that to be a really interesting and very relatable concept, to be able to sit there with, like, especially Finn's character as well, who's like 18 or whatever. And he's like, Mom, I'm 18. Like, one of my favorite scenes in the whole film, it's not even like a ghostbusting scene. It's like a scene where Finn goes down to ask his mom for some help because he heard a noise in the attic, and she's like, "Oh no, you're an adult now. You can handle it."
Yeah.
I just love that moment, and I think that's the moment that leads to, well, I won't say anything, but yeah, there's some really cool stuff in there. Obviously, you heard in the Gil interview, there's a throwback to the library ghost. That's actually in the trailer. It's not a spoiler. But the way that they found that footage, I mean, I think Sean and I's jaws hit the floor when he was telling us that story about the 70 story. Millimeter. Yeah. And shout out to Sean's opening spin doctors thing was brilliant. I didn't know that was going to happen. I lost it. But yeah, there's... to me, like, that's what makes the film work. I think the characters are great. Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon are amazing. But to me, it's all about Phoebe. It's all about McKenna Grace. And do we know the name of the actress who plays her friend in the movie?
Wasn't she Snakebite Jane in Dr. Sleep?
I'd love. Oh, yes, interesting. You're right. It is the same actor.
Yeah.
But I want to give her credit.
Emily Allen Lind.
Okay.
Yeah,
she has one of my favorite performances in the whole film. Like and that's connected somehow to the Phoebe character. And I wasn't even planning on really bringing that up. So that's why I didn't look up the name initially. Yeah. But now that I'm thinking about it, like those are some of my favorite scenes. I actually found the quiet scenes in this movie to be more interesting than some of the ghostbusting sequences. And so on a negative note, my only real big problem with this film is the heavy exposition. And what's ironic about that, and Sean, you and I were sitting in the interview, Gil talks about bringing exposition back into movies. You remember that, yeah. Sean?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So I remember it because that's my biggest and complaint about the film.
Like a big mythology, yeah. Like adding mythology to the film.
Yeah, or telling stories. And like, for me, I've always had a problem with the way the MCU TV shows use exposition. They have to remind us constantly about what happened in the past 24 films so that we can catch up to where they are. And I think there's a little bit of that here. Like, they're playing to an audience that may not have seen the first two, so they have to catch you up somehow. And I think for me as a Ghostbusters fan, I just got kind of bored during that stuff. I knew it already. I understood what they did already. So it was kind of like I just had to sit through some of the exposition to kind of get to the newer story. And I kind of wanted more focus on the newer story than I did want on the exposition. But it's all legacy. It ties together. I also appreciate how much they gave Aykroyd to do in this one. And
dude, I honestly thought it was a better use of the original characters than Afterlife.
100%. I did not like the way they were used in Afterlife. And I know Jake texted this the other day, so I'll let Jake take this from here. I didn't love the Harold Ramis ghost in Afterlife. I thought that it should have been the three originals plus McKenna and then no Ramis ghost, because I understand the emotion of bringing him in. It just didn't feel right to me. And I get that the family may have been involved and allowed it, but I just didn't particularly find that great. But I think overall I was very happy just with feeling like a kid again, watching a Ghostbusters film that actually worked. Again, like Sean said, doesn't change the world. It's nowhere near the first two, but it's the closest you'll get to that feeling. And that story that Gil told us about pitching it to Ivan was beautiful. But Jake, you go ahead.
You know, I really like this movie. You know, it's funny. I feel like the thing that Sean and I got most excited about whenever we were sort of texting back and forth was just that it feels like a Ghostbusters movie. Like, yeah. That's kind of what we were. And Sean, I was thinking the exact same thing. Like, if this was Ghostbusters 4 and it came out in 1993, like this feels like it could have been that. And, you know, the fact that we're like, it's called Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. But the fact that we are like, let's consider it Ghostbusters 4. The fact that we're talking about Ghostbusters 4 on the 40th anniversary of the original. And the fact that it's for me a very happy 3.5 out of 5, 7 out of 10. I consider that a win. Like, I'm not exactly sure what people were expecting out of this. I thought it was fun. I had a good time with it. There were a couple of moments of silliness that I could have thought, like, okay, like, because look, I want my Ghostbusters to be funny, but there are a couple of moments where I thought, like, you could scale back the silliness a little bit right there. But they're nitpicks by this point. I walked out just going, that was fun. Like, that's kind of what I wanted it to be. I will say that it's probably, discounting the remake from a few years back, like considering just the four that features the OG cast. This is probably my least favorite. Like, they probably go in descending, or, you know, it's probably 1, 2, Afterlife, and then Frozen Empire. I rewatched, you know, to your point, Kevin, I will say that in talking to people about Frozen Empire and that there's a new Ghostbusters coming out, something I feel like I've been getting a lot is people pausing and going, did I see the last one? I don't know if I saw the last one. Like, even the reason that I rewatched Afterlife over the weekend was because my girlfriend hadn't seen it. She kind of paused and goes, oh, I really want to see the new Ghostbusters. And then she goes, I don't think I saw the last Ghostbusters. So I do feel like they are kind of, you know, potentially concerned with just how, because keep in mind, it came out during COVID and it was sort of a weird time where, you know, And this is another point that I thought, just because, you know, I've been a big defender of how they used Harold Ramis in Afterlife. And I was a fan. And that scene where she can barely, you know, hold on to her proton pack and then it's him sort of holding her and helping her. That scene still gets me. But whenever I was explaining to my girlfriend about, you know, hey, keep in mind, you know, since Ghostbusters 2, one of the Ghostbusters has passed away, so he's obviously not in this film. Her initial reaction was, okay, but it's a Ghostbusters movie. Like, they couldn't find a way. And I sort of paused and went, that's exactly right. So, you know, if there were ever a movie to have a reason to bring someone back and with the blessing of his family, I felt like Ghostbusters had a right to it. I actually thought they handled it in a really... That being said, obviously, it's not really, you know, obviously he's not in Frozen Empire and in a way that, you know, the McKenna Grace is able to sort of continue on that legacy. But I liked it. It's fun. It's not going to I'm probably not going to be thinking much about it in a week or so, but I was very happy to experience it on the big screen.
I think my only my, Real quick, I know my only problem with the Ramis ghost, and Jake, you watched it more recently than I did. He doesn't speak, right?
Never speaks. And I like that he doesn't speak.
See, that bothered me. It was because like they didn't have dialogue for him. So like I guess they could have used AI or whatever to create the voice. It didn't like I don't know. It felt like I was watching something that was put into the movie without narrative reasoning, in my opinion.
The OG guys saying things like I'm sorry and then cutting to him just kind of like nodding. Like,
no, but he needed to speak.
I strong disagree.
Why wouldn't Egon speak?
I mean, that's a taste thing. I disagree, though. I think that it was fine. I felt it was very touching. And I think that because it was Afterlife was bringing the original back, like it was
right.
It was Jason Reitman doing it. Ivan Reitman was a part of it.
I get it.
Even Bill Murray is a part of it. I think that when you have, if it was anything other than everyone being back and sharing a special moment, and particularly with Jason Reitman being there and recreating a literal piece of his childhood, I think to me it's a very touching thing of let's find a tasteful way to make him a part of it and literally pass the torch to this new character that's going to bring that legacy. I always enjoyed it. I think that, sure, it's never going to be perfect because he's passed, but I think that they handled it in a way that I felt was more sentimental and touching rather than being exploitative or, you know, sort of spectacle. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I agree with what Gabe just said. I mean, in terms of what they were intending to do. But do you guys remember like what they did with Carrie Fisher and like there was just like in other films that like I just felt like it.
A couple of these movies have been trying to get over to it.
I just don't feel like it's worked yet. It's not just the Ramis one. There's other ones that I haven't felt worked either. It just feels, I guess, strange to me.
It's not the same thing, but just in terms of sort of like, you know, using the face and, you know, deconstruction. Someone just asked George Miller why they didn't DH Charlize Theron, and he was like, because I saw The Irishman and it didn't work.
Interesting.
Oh, come on now. The Irishman's a good movie. I don't like this retroactive shitting on The Irishman.
I love The Irishman. Story. I don't think the technology was needed. I don't think we needed to do the de-aging thing.
I saw a deep fake on X.
It looks better.
That someone did for Irishman that looked a thousand times better.
Oh, really? I agree with you. It's on
Send
YouTube.
Send me that
I agree
if you
with
say
you.
It. I would like and to
the,
see that.
And the worst part of the Irishman was 80-year-old Robert De Niro attempting to kick like a 30-year-old Robert De Niro.
But that's an unfair of like it was better after they made it. The technology has been rapidly improving on a weekly basis for the last several years. So as soon they cut print on a movie, it's better by the time.
Yeah, but you know, but I mean, keep in mind, De Niro won his first Oscar for playing a young version of Marlon Brando. Like, when there's a great
history.
I
don't think we need to rehash the issue of Irishman. I just don't think we need to do that.
So anyway, Frozen Empire. So ultimately, all three of us recommend it. We think it's totally fun.
As do I had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Gabe got a chance to see it last night also.
It's a kind of recommendation where like our octave goes up like one level. Like, yeah, it was good.
I will step in and say that, and this is a bit of a cop out. I don't go into Ghostbusters expecting to put my critical hat on. I want it to be fun. I want a little bit of Bill Murray humor. And I want it to be a little bit on the edge of, wait, is this this is for kids, right? You know, I want a little bit of that. It had that. It was fun. I felt like it was recapturing the idea of a almost procedural type, you know, mission based. These are Ghostbusters that are, you know, firefighters, cops, that kind of thing. Like those procedural dramas that you see. I felt like it was pushing itself into that direction and I just had fun with him.
I do have a hot take though.
Hold on. Do we all agree that Afterlife almost wanted to be treated like a serious movie? Like, I think Afterlife thought it was a little bit better than it actually was.
I'd have to rewatch it. I've only seen it once.
It's like, pretty well made. Like, there are some gorgeous shots. It's well directed.
But I got a little bit of sense that Jason Reitman felt like, I'm bringing back this prestigious
project. I don't know. I mean, whenever Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon are like the, you know, possessed and they're like the demon dogs and stuff like that. It's hard to watch that scene and think that Reitman's taking himself very seriously.
All right, let's shift over to your streaming options for the week, which is Netflix's new film or new series from the former co-creators of Game of Thrones, Benioff and Weiss, who, all right, let's get this out of the way. Their controversial involvement in the Game of Thrones series and everybody kind of wondering what they are going to do next as their big follow up. It's called Three Body Problem. It's an adaptation of the science fiction novel that I think is a trilogy of books. And so if these guys are going to continue making this series, they have material that they can continue to mine. When Jake and I got a chance to go to South By, this was an unusual thing. We don't often get told this, but Netflix kind of said to us, hey, before you get a chance to interview David and Daniel and then Alexander Wu, try to watch the entire series. And while we didn't get through the entire series before getting a chance to sit down and talk with them, we watched a huge chunk of it. And I understand now why they were saying this. And we're going to sort of keep this to a surface reaction just to let you guys dive into it on your own. But my biggest thing is be patient with it, because it is it's not even that it has pacing issues, but the initial two episodes of the series is a lot to download. There are a lot of characters that need to be set up. There's a significant amount of both science knowledge and historical knowledge that are very important to the overall story. But you're going to get fed a lot of it up front. And it was never, and Jake, maybe you disagree with this. To me, it was never to the point where I was confused by what was going on or who was who and what their point in the story was going forward. It jumps back and forth between the 1960s and a scientist who is participating in an experimental new program that has to do with communication, extraterrestrial? Okay. Intergalactic?
Interplanetary?
Interplanetary?
Planetary? I don't know what you're looking for.
Interstellar. It was...
Are you singing a Beastie Boys song?
I might be trying to sing a Beastie Boys song right now. Speaking to aliens. How about that?
There we go.
And also a group of scientists in the modern day who are all dying mysteriously. It's a lot to process, and you may be getting through the first two episodes and saying, like, is this going to be worth my time? I actually saw somebody compare it to Lost, and the way Lost rolled out, a lot of central mysteries.
Jake looked offended by that.
Yeah. How Lost rolled out a lot of mysteries like Smoke Monster and The Hatch and the others, and what is actually going on, and are you going to be rewarded ultimately for this? I think you are. I think it's worth sticking with. So that's my recommendation on Three Body Problem. Be patient with it and be curious with it, because there's a lot going on with it. But overall, I liked it a lot.
So, you know, and here's, you know, I really want to double down on what Sean said, because as someone who has finished the entire first season and wants to see this thing play out, my concern is that at a time where I feel like people need to be grabbed by not just the first episode, but the first 15 minutes of the first episode. I think it's an 8-episode first season. I don't know about you, Sean, I think it's a solid 3 episodes before you even really get a grasp for what this show actually is and what it's going to be. Okay. And, you know, I agree with you in that I wasn't so much confused as I was concerned about, like, there were things happening where I sort of thought, am I supposed to know what this means yet? Did I miss something because I don't know? And then you realize, you know, case in point, there's a plot point, it's in the trailer, involving this sort of helmet that the characters put on. And it takes them to sort of a virtual reality world. Mm-hmm. And that's in the first couple of episodes. And the whole time I'm watching this going, wait, what is this exactly? And why does this keep, why do they keep doing this?
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell, did I miss something? A lot of things the characters don't know yet either. And it takes sometimes 3 or 4 episodes for them to say, okay, well, here's the whole reason. Here's the whole thing behind the helmet, you know? Mm-hmm. So be patient. It is truly worth it. But, you know, if everyone turns on the first episode of this show and then bails, we're not going to get. And I don't think it's comparable to Lost or even comparable to a Game of Thrones, because there is an end. It's 3 books. Every season's going to be a book.
Yeah.
The end of the story is written. Well, but we're never going to see it if people don't watch it.
And I'll argue that with Game of Thrones and Lost, they both had tremendous pilots. that at the end of the pilot, you were like, oh, I want to see what happens next.
Yes.
With three body problem, that moment to me happened at the end of episode two. There's something that happens at the end of episode two where I was like, oh, what? Oh, oh, OK. Yeah. And now I'm going to keep going. And then it propels you forward. I thought it's expertly structured in that the end of every episode is something happens and you're like, oh, I guess I'm going to keep going. Like, I guess I got to press play on this. And it's funny, like I texted Jake pretty early on because of the need for us to watch this really quickly.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not sure what I'm doing with this. Yeah. And then he was like, I think you were like an episode ahead of me and you were always like, no, 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 keep going. You got to get to this. And then I was like, OK, now I'm on board. I'm fully.
Yeah. And then there's one moment. I'm not going to say when it happens, but there is one moment later in the show that I think is going to be the universal. Everyone going, OK, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah. So. All right. Three Body Problem. It's available for you on Netflix right now. Let's throw it to a really quick break and we'll continue on the other side. And we are back. Okay, I want to throw to the idea that the new horror film with Sydney Sweeney, Immaculate, is coming to theaters. And the reason why we are postponing our conversation of that is we're going to have the director on the show joining us next week for a full in-depth spoiler conversation about Immaculate. All three of us have seen it. All three of us love it. We highly recommend it. You need to go see it. And so make sure this is your assignment, your homework assignment for Real Blend. Make sure you see Immaculate before next week's episode, where we are going to do a deep dive conversation with the director about all things Immaculate and Sydney
Sweeney.
Take
the whole family.
Yeah, great idea. And the reason why we are putting a pin in Immaculate is because we want to talk about Roadhouse, which is Jake Gyllenhaal's
Roadhouse
film that opened the South by Southwest Film Festival recently, is coming to Amazon Prime Video, and is a, I'm not even going to justify this with this, with the fact that it's loosely associated with Patrick Swayze's movie, because it doesn't deserve it. I am in the minority on this film, apparently. I thought it was boring as hell.
Why do you hate Doug Liman?
Doug Liman's fine. I love Conor McGregor, apparently. Conor McGregor steals this movie away from Jake Gyllenhaal.
He does.
And not until he shows up a good 90 minutes into the movie did I care what the hell was going on. It is as formulaic as you can get, especially if you even know the one sentence premise of Roadhouse, which is... and it's not even, he's not even a Zen type of anti-violence, you know, pacifist-esque bouncer. He's an ex-UFC fighter with serious anger problems who decides to take a gig down at a roadhouse in Florida and help this woman clean up the issues that she's having. I saw no point to the movie. I didn't. I thought Gyllenhaal was kind of mailing it in. I didn't get into the vibe of the roadhouse. I love the first movie for what it is. I didn't see the necessity for this. And then when Conor McGregor showed up, I thought he was colorful and fun and had a good time with him. But ultimately, when it ended, I was like, didn't need that. Didn't need that one bit. And Kevin's making faces all over the place. So apparently he loves it and it's going to make his top 10.
Loving it is a strong word. I think also my point is I don't have a romantic image of the first one in my mind. It came out, what was it, 89 was the year that film came out, or somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was 5 years old. It wasn't a movie I watched all the time. I've seen it in bits and pieces on TV. I have no like dedication to the original Roadhouse. So my entrance into this story was just like, I knew it was a remake or a reimagining. I knew that Doug Liman directed it. I just thought it was goofy and fun. Like the tone was interesting. Like it was like over the top. I thought Gyllenhaal was great. I thought the UFC stuff was awesome, how they shot all that, like the logistics behind the scenes. They had to wait in between the cards of a real UFC fight. Like really interesting how they were able to pull that.
That's cool.
Oh, dude, the way they did it was so
those sequences are cool.
So for people who don't know, there's a backstory to Gyllenhaal's character where he was a former UFC fighter, as Sean mentioned. So they keep flashing back to these sequences of him at a major UFC fight where he did some terrible damage to the guy he was fighting. And I guess they wanted to shoot this at a real UFC match. And apparently they were supposed to shoot it at UFC 283. But then Jake Gyllenhaal got COVID. So they had to wait like 2 months. He had to stay in the same shape and everything for those 2 months.
Oh, man.
And then they get to 285 and they basically were sitting behind the scenes. There was the I think they fought in an undercard when they actually filmed it. But there was the undercard and then there's the pay-per-view. So the whole show is timed out. So the way Jake Gyllenhaal explained it to me was, if everything ran on time, they would have had 1 minute and 45 seconds to shoot the fight. But they got lucky because not every fight went full. So they ended up with 7 minutes.
Oh, cool.
So there was a 7 minute period where they could jump in the ring and then Doug Liman could call action and they would pick up the fight. And essentially they had to get genuine crowd reactions from it. And what I thought was really, really cool about it was, like, imagine like that adrenaline. You have like one, you have one shot, you have one moment to get all of that right. And it's all hinging on. So Gyllenhaal explained that they had three plans. There was three plans for three timing mechanisms. If they had a minute 45, this is how they would shoot it. If they had 5 minutes, this is how they shoot it. This is 7 minutes, this is how we would shoot it.
It's pretty cool.
And so, like, it's really cool. And, like, the logistics behind it. And I told Gyllenhaal, it reminds me exactly what Bradley Cooper did in Star is Born. It's the exact same thing. Because, like, for people who remember, Cooper went out on real stages in between real live sets. One of them happened to be, ironically, Kris Kristofferson he was following, which is crazy, in real life. But, you know, they would go out and he would film a concert in front of a real crowd. They had no idea what they were doing. I'm sure they knew it was Cooper and they knew it was Gyllenhaal. But, like, kind of cool stuff. I love filmmaking like that. And it kind of, the vibe of that does come across, like him weighing in, like that's all real happening at the fight.
Right.
And Connor is amazing. I think you're right. I think he steals the movie, but I thought it was goofy fun. I just thought it was, and it was R rated. It's super violent. I just thought it was, I don't know. I enjoyed it. It's not perfect. It's not even a great movie. It's just fun. You know,
Jakey, yeah. Where are you on this?
I don't really think it was fun enough. I feel like it took itself too seriously and wasn't good enough to take it as seriously as it was taking itself. I think it's getting a lot of like passes because it's a remake of a movie that people. Here's the thing about this movie. I think if you remove the connection to a movie that people look back on with nostalgia, if this were just a movie called Roadhouse, and it wasn't a remake and it came out and it was that movie, I think we would all look at it and go, why did Gyllenhaal do this? Like, what was it about this movie that you know? And there's nothing about, other than the character's name and the concept of Roadhouse, there's nothing to it. I mean, the original takes place in Missouri. This one takes place in Florida. Like, there's nothing about it.
Well, that's
that
a
really
huge missed opportunity. I thought putting it in Florida would open it up to a lot more weirdness. And there's a bit, like there's a sequence with an alligator that kind of caught me off guard that I thought was funny, but I wanted more of that. I wanted more of it to be kind of bizarro. Yeah.
Sean, I don't know why this reminded me of it, but the Florida stuff reminded me of the Fassbender stuff in The Killer when he went to Florida. Just the vibe of that. Like, it had that, like that vibe to it. The way the Roadhouse felt, like the way Fincher captured that, like that whole sequence in Florida.
I can see that.
I think, yeah, I don't know why I just kept thinking about that, but yeah, I thought, listen, it's fun. It's goofy. It's on Amazon Prime Video.
Yeah.
Which I think is smart. I don't think it would have done well in theaters. I really don't.
Which is funny, because I feel like that's one of the massive narratives following this movie was like, it should be in theaters. It should be. And whenever I watched it, I sort of thought like, this feels right.
and you're right. What Jake's talking about is there was a whole thing online about Doug Liman and there's this whole conversation happening back and forth about whether
Doug Liman didn't do the junket, to say the least.
Right. And I will say this, though. There's another movie coming to Prime in May called The Idea of You with Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzine. And that movie, I think, would actually do well in theaters.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think that movie's trailer views are insane. And I think that one, I think Prime should look at a theatrical, maybe a couple week theatrical prior. I think that could do well.
We will be discussing that film on the show. I can say that.
Yes, we will. We have director Michael Showalter joining us for a special spot on the Roadland podcast. While we're giving out streaming recommendations, after you have pressed play on Roadhouse, head over to Disney Plus. I want to let everybody know that X-Men 97 is there. The first two episodes at least are up and running. I got a chance to see the third episode as well, too. It's tremendous. If you grew up on the series, if you just want to see the X-Men back in the MCU, I find this fascinating because this is the first official MCU angle on the X-Men since they have reacquired the property from 20th Century Fox. And I think the love and care goes into the creation of those characters. So please give that a shot on Disney Plus. It's very, very entertaining. As you guys are heading out, hit the comments down below and let us know. And this, you might think that this is an easy question, but it's not. as easy as you anticipate, because there are a lot of people who have some love for Ghostbusters 2. If you were to sit down and watch one of them this evening, are you going Ghostbusters 1 or Ghostbusters 2? Do you have a preference of one or the other? Let us know in the comments down below. In the meantime, and while you're down there, let us know what you thought about Frozen Empire or Roadhouse or Three Body Problem, if you give it a shot. I want to hear you guys' takes on all of those. We will be back with a brand new episode next week. Thank you guys for checking the show out this week. Follow us on social media. We are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean underscore O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. And the show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week with a brand new episode. And until then, Larry Crown.
Christopher Nolan horror movie?
Ooh, okay. I'm down for that.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.